And welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Six Philadelphia public schools have now closed because of asbestos problems as the school district scrambles to make repairs and minimize the loss of instruction time. Damaged asbestos is just one of a number of environmental problems plaguing Philadelphia's public schools, most of which were built long before the fibers were discovered to be harmful. This hour, we'll hear from a parent whose children are being displaced by the asbestos problem, and we'll also hear from reporter Kristen Graham, who's been covering the story for the Philadelphia Inquirer. But we begin in the Garden State, where a number of stories have been making headlines, from the Democratic congressman who switched parties in the midst of last week's impeachment activities to new legislation that would restore voting rights to those on probation and parole. WHYY's Joe Hernandez is here to catch us up on some of the major stories coming out of New Jersey. Joe covers New Jersey state government for WHYY and WBGO in Newark. Joe, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to start off with an audio clip from last Friday. This is Congressman Jeff Van Drew, a longtime Democrat in New Jersey. He met last week in the Oval Office with President Trump, having switched allegiances. And let's take a listen to this.
This is who I am. It's who I always was, but there was more tolerance of moderate Democrats, of blue dog Democrats, of conservative Democrats, and I think that's going away. You have my undying support.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And always.
And by the way, the same way.
Thank you.
I'm endorsing him, okay?
Wait, what?
Right.
I think that may have been what a lot of people said when they heard that last week. So what was behind the switch?
A lot. So impeachment obviously was the big political news last week, but the big local political news was this Van Drew switch from Democrat to Republican. And we'd been hearing rumblings about it for a little while. I think the weekend before news broke that he was thinking about it. And then all week there was this suspicion. People were trying to ask him. He was being coy about it. And then he shows up in the Oval Office with President Trump. And I think if you kind of look at Van Drew's district and his history, it makes a little bit more sense than just a random Democrat is switching to become a Republican. He's from this district in South Jersey that leans conservative. He has always leaned conservative in his votes and his beliefs. And so as shocking as it was, many people, I think, who kind of follow South Jersey politics said, all right, if anyone's going to do it, it's probably going to be Jeff Van Drew.
So where exactly is his district? What can you tell us about that?
His district is the southernmost congressional district in New Jersey, and it touches all of and parts of eight counties in South Jersey because it's a lot less populous down there, so it covers a lot of land. It's the largest district by land in New Jersey. So this includes, Philadelphia suburbs, Jersey Shore, everything in between, Millville, Vineland, Bridgeton, farm towns. It's very rural down there. And this is a part of New Jersey which, you know, is a reliably blue state that kind of leans conservative and has elected many Republicans. Frank Lomiondo was the Republican congressman in that seat for 20 years before Jeff Van Drew came along and flipped it blue. And so Van Drew has always been from that area, and he's always leaned conservative like the constituency down there, but he's always been a Democrat.
Was he in danger of losing his seat for re-election? Was there something there that helped to prompt the switch?
I mean, there had been polling from Stockton University about impeachment, and if you looked at that poll statewide, it found that people generally supported impeaching President Trump. But if you zoomed in on Van Drew's district and where he was from, that support turned to opposition. And so I think Van Drew saw that poll and others that he did independently and thought that he may be in danger of losing re-election in 2020.
Well, it sounds like he's still in danger because there are now a number of people who are challenging him.
It's a different kind of danger now. I mean, he's facing several Republican primary opponents who were in the race before he made this switch. He's now facing several Democratic opponents who are saying, look at this guy. He was a Democrat for all this time. You voted in a Democrat. Now he's become a Republican. So don't you want a Democrat back in this seat? So he's going to have an interesting re-election. Now, in the clip we just heard, President Trump said, same goes to you, right, that you have my support as well. I'm going to endorse him. So whether Trump comes back down to South Jersey, maybe takes a spin through Atlantic City and some of his old casinos and endorses Van Drew, we'll see what kind of effect that has on Vander's reelection. But Trump, as we know, is also going to have a busy year, so who knows if he'll make it up
here.
He'll
follow through on that. How have Democrats reacted to Vander's decision?
Confusion, anger. I think a lot of people are saying that, you know, the governor of the state and some of the Democratic leaders in the legislature have all said that it's kind of a silly, stupid thing for Vander to do, and that they disagreed with it, and they've basically disavowed him now. And he's been in the Democratic Party, which in New Jersey can be, you know, tight-knit, for decades, and now he's kind of been shut out of that. So they have not reacted favorably to this move.
He's also lost most of his staff, I hear.
Six, I think, of his staff quit right away. They're being rehired. But, a lot of his staff also, they wrote in a letter that this is not the party of Donald Trump is not what they signed up for. And so that's why they all resigned.
And before we move on to some other things, Joe, I'm just wondering, how does this play out then politically for him over the next year? Because when you look at his voting record, I mean, he has not voted in lockstep with Trump's agenda leading up to, even though he may lean conservative. I mean, you think of like the Paris Climate Accord was one of those decisions where he went the opposite way. So wondering how this may play out going forward in terms of his voting record.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see if he gets more in lockstep with the Republican Party on some of those issues. I mean, in the state legislature, he voted for gun rights. He's a gun owner. He voted against same-sex marriage. But as you say, he did vote also for some Democratic priorities. So, we'll see if his desire for the support of the Republican Party going into the 2020 election means that he votes with them on some of these other key issues that are important to them.
All right. Got to move on. We have a couple more topics to cover in the next few minutes. And one is about the vaccination legislation in New Jersey. That has gotten a lot of attention. What happened there?
So this is a bill that would eliminate the religious exemption for vaccines in New Jersey. And basically, if you are a parent and you have a child who is of the age that they require certain vaccines, you can say that your, you know, bona fide religious beliefs, that your faith prohibits you from vaccinating your child, and you could get an exemption for that. State lawmakers say, you know, this exemption endangers public health because we have too many people taking the religious exemption, and that means that these children are not vaccinated for preventable diseases and that they could, you know, be the source of or be subject to outbreaks like measles. There was a measles outbreak in Ocean County, I think it was earlier this year, in a part of Ocean County that is very religious. There's a large Jewish population there. So this bill would eliminate that religious exemption, which has been in state law for a long time.
We also saw that in New York, too,
yes,
I think within the last year or so in New York and other parts of New Jersey. So what actually happened? The legislature was considering this bill. What ultimately happened with it?
Ultimately, it's been tabled. The opposition was extremely strong, and parents and people, you know, doctors, people who opposed vaccines on religious grounds and on other grounds showed up to the state house and were very vocal in their opposition. So it got through two committees, and then it was taken up by both the Assembly and the State Senate on the same day. And I was there that day. It was some of the loudest protests I had heard at the state house. I mean, I haven't been covering it, you know, a year or two, but it was extremely loud. People were outside chanting. People were inside chanting, singing, insulting lawmakers as they walked by and interrupting the proceedings. But in the Assembly, it passed. But then it went over to the state Senate, and it was going to be voted on that day, but they didn't have enough support for it. And so ultimately, the leaders in the Senate pulled it down. So right now, it's tabled. The Senate President Steve Sweeney said he intends to bring it up again. There's two more voting sessions in January. And Governor Phil Murphy has indicated that he might, you know, sign it. He's a religious person himself, but he says that we should be guided by science on this issue.
So we haven't heard the last of this, is what
No, not yet.
It'll be coming back before we know it. Want to talk too about some other legislation that Governor Phil Murphy signed last week that restores voting rights for certain groups of people with criminal convictions. So who would be eligible now under this new law?
Anyone who lives in New Jersey who is on probation or parole would have their voting rights restored, because previously, if you were on probation or parole or were in prison, you could not vote. And now those people on probation and parole can. It's about 80,000 people who will be eligible in New Jersey.
So that's a pretty large group.
Yes.
What about those who are currently incarcerated? Is there any effort to try to restore rights to them?
So there are two states, Maine and Vermont, that allow people who are currently in prison to vote from prison, but only two states of 50. In New Jersey, this bill that became law, originally in the language, it said people on probation and parole and those in prison would be able to vote. But through the negotiating process, or, you know, however these bills get made, that part was taken out because I think it was seen as a little bit too controversial, a step maybe too far. Mm. But some of the sponsors have said, you know, it's great that we got this. We have people on probation and parole. Now the next step maybe is to extend that right to vote to people currently in prison. So I don't think we've seen the last of this either, but there's no bill, you know, proposing to do that right now that's been introduced.
Hmm. So how many other states have similar legislation to this, at least for people who are on parole or probation?
Washington, D.C. allows it, and New Jersey will be the 17th state to allow it. So 16 other states plus D.C. allow people on probation and parole to vote.
Hmm. Do you anticipate, just from your, you know, working on this topic, that we'll see more states sort of following suit?
I think it's possible, and I think one reason that that seems likely is because it's not just blue states that are doing this. There are red states that are doing it as well, so I think it's kind of seen as a less controversial issue than some other criminal justice issues. However, in New Jersey, there was some strong opposition from Republicans. They said, you know, people broke the rules of society. They should fulfill their full sentences for those convictions before we let them back in to have a say in how society moves forward and how we form our government. But ultimately, the Democrats control the legislature and the governor's office, and they supported it, and so it became law.
Joe, in our last 45 seconds or so, there was one other piece of legislation. It was sort of like a clean slate law that seals certain convictions. What can you tell us about that?
So this expands who's eligible for expungements, and it does this clean slate mechanism for people who have been convicted of not the most serious crimes and who haven't recommitted crimes in 10 years after their conviction. This was originally tied to legislation that would legalize recreational marijuana, mm-hmm. but that didn't have enough support, so they kind of separated these two issues. So they move forward with the expungement bill, which will help people with certain less serious drug convictions. But recreational marijuana is going to be on the 2020 ballot. It's going to be a ballot question now because they didn't have enough support among lawmakers.
Lot going on in the Garden State, Joe. You've got your work cut out for you. Thank you so much for being with us on Radio Times Regional Roundup. When we come back, we'll be talking about the asbestos issue in Philly schools. Six of them shut down now. We'll talk with Kristen Graham from the Philadelphia Inquirer and a parent whose children have been displaced. Don't go away. We'll be back in just a moment.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. Two more Philadelphia public schools have had to close due to what the school district calls imminent hazards from damaged asbestos. That brings the total to six schools now that have shut down since the school year began. The school district's aging infrastructure is creating a host of problems that are putting the health of students, teachers, and staff at risk. From lead paint to asbestos particles, there are more problems than the district has resources to fix. A little later on, we'll hear from one parent whose three children have been displaced from their elementary school and who is advocating for a better learning environment for all students. But first, Philadelphia Inquirer reporter Kristen Graham joins us in the studio. Kristen is the urban education writer with a focus on the Philadelphia School District and issues facing schools and cities across the region and beyond. Kristen, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Tracy.
And by the way, we want to invite our audience to chime in on this discussion. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, or of course you can always pick up the phone and call us at 888-477-9499. With all that said, Kristen, let's start at the beginning. What exactly is asbestos, and at what point does it become dangerous?
So asbestos is a material that was used a lot in before we knew it was dangerous, for fireproofing, for soundproofing, and especially used a lot in schools because obviously we want those buildings to be safe. And undamaged asbestos is fine. If it's intact, it's okay. But once it becomes damaged, it can release fibers into the air that are cancer-causing and can cause other respiratory complications as well.
And how does it get damaged?
So in a school, I mean, if you know, it's just normal wear and tear. If you're in a gym and there's asbestos over a pipe and a basketball hits it, that, you know, could potentially damage it. Asbestos tiles are used in lots of places as well, and those are a big source of problems.
So give us a sense of the scope of this problem. We're up to 6 schools now that have had to close and redistribute their students. How big a problem is this throughout the district?
So this is, you know, we know that most schools in the district do still have asbestos. 175 roughly of the district's roughly 220 schools do have some asbestos, and the number is 6 schools that have been displaced, but there's actually a 7th building, an early childhood center that does not house elementary kids but early childhood students, that where asbestos was also found, and those students had to be relocated. So it's an enormous problem, and you know, one that we know roughly what the scope is, because the district by federal law does 6 inspections every 6 months, kind of walkthroughs, and then every 3 years more intense inspections. But asbestos is being, you know, could be damaged at any point.
Well, I want to follow up on that because you've written about some of those inspections. And let me just say as well that we are standing by for a statement from the school district as well. So we'll read that as soon as that comes. But I was interested to read in a piece that you wrote very recently about the last 2 schools that were closed, that there are inspections that are supposed to take place that are mandated every 3 years, and then sort of less of a deep dive every 6 months, a more visual inspection. And yet, Kristen, at one of these schools, I think it was Carnell, staff there say that these conditions have been like this for 8 years or more.
Well, one of the things we know is that there's a backlog of asbestos mm-hmm. issues. The district does not have the resources in terms of human capital or in terms of financial capital to handle all of the damaged asbestos that we know exists. So, you know, if something is flagged as an imminent hazard now, you know, since the asbestos issue has kind of been mushrooming, the superintendent has said, you know, we're going to respond to every report of damaged asbestos within 24 hours. But, you know, that certainly wasn't the case for years leading up to it.
Yeah. And so now the school district has pledged to become much more proactive in light of these complaints.
They have pledged to be more proactive, but I think we need to be realistic about the resources they have. I mean, obviously they're hiring outside contractors to sort of help with the look, but at the same time, it's, you know, the district's resources are still what they are.
Yeah. What are we talking about in terms of what it would cost to really remedy this problem?
So, you know, there are various estimates. I think, you know, because we don't know every place where asbestos is damaged, a lot of it is up in the air. You know, 100 million has been one number that's been floated. The district said about 3 or 4 years ago that it would take $5 billion to fix all of its unmet capital needs. And that's certainly not just asbestos. It's mm-hmm. lead paint. A lot of it is electrical work, you know, upgrading old electrical systems, you know, fixing roofs, things like that. But that's clearly something that the district does not have the money to handle on its own.
I was reading, and I don't know if it was your piece or someone else's, that there was something like $12 million that was going to be dedicated out of $150 million toward repairing asbestos, but that it was nowhere near.
Sure, that kind of scratches the surface. The district went out for its capital program, as it does. It, you know, sold bonds, and $12 million of that will go to asbestos. But, you know, we know the needs are much greater than $12 million. And, you know, the state has kind of stepped up for some to fix some capital issues. But, you know, what we're hearing from a lot of folks is, you know, this is going to take, you know, the federal government, this is going to take more state money, you know, just kind of all anyone who has a stake in it to come forward with new solutions.
And the school district really is at the mercy of the city and the state in terms of the funding. It's not like it can raise its own funding for this.
Right. The school district is unique in Pennsylvania. It's the only school board that does not have taxing power. So, you know, city council, it goes to city council and says, this is what we need. And, you know, has done a good job in recent years of being transparent about what its, needs are around the, you know, on the horizon. But at the same time, you know, if city council says no, if the state says no, then there's no remedy.
And Kristen, you know this probably better than anyone, that there does seem to be a resistance, at least at the state level, to those things that affect Philadelphia, that they just
Absolutely.
Don't necessarily get the urgency, right?
Absolutely. I mean, there's certainly a sense in many quarters in Harrisburg that Philadelphia, you know, is wasteful with its money, that, you know, they don't know how to spend it, that the needs are too great, mm-hmm. that they always have their hand out. And so there's a definite resistance on the part of a lot of state lawmakers who control the purse strings.
Yeah, and yet we're in crisis with kids in dangerous buildings. I want to go to the phones. Emily is standing by to join in the conversation. Emily, welcome to Radio Times. Hi, Emily.
Hi,
are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Go ahead with your comment or your question.
Yeah, so I'm the school nurse at McClure Elementary School. I'm here with Shade, who's a teacher at the school. And we are one of the schools that was closed last Thursday due to damaged asbestos in the school. We've actually been getting trying to get someone to take our concerns seriously for the past 4 months. You know, we're supposed to have all these systems in place to keep us safe, to monitor the schools. But unfortunately, that's not what's been happening. We even had a district-sponsored walkthrough of our building 2 weeks ago that did not find any of these concerns that are keeping our building closed today.
Well, Emily, thank you for calling in, and we're glad that at least everyone is being moved to a different place. You've been covering that story, Kristen.
Absolutely, and have talked to Emily and to Sade, and have heard from folks in other schools too who feel like their concerns have not been taken seriously. Franklin Learning Center is another school that has, you know, years of complaints that were sort of just not, the urgency wasn't there on the school district's part. And the McClure folks, as Emily explained, you know, have said that they've lodged their complaints routinely and just haven't had response.
Yeah. So now that students and staff are being moved, where are these kids going now?
So the McClure situation in Carnell, those students, that happened just before break. So the students finished on Friday. They had their last day before winter break on Friday. Teachers are in school today. But what the district said for Carnell and for McClure was, we're just going to, you know, those students are just going to have extra days in their break. In other situations, the district has had to either rent space or put students in, you know, spaces that weren't originally supposed to be. In the case of Benjamin Franklin High School, which houses Benjamin Franklin and Science Leadership Academy, because it houses two schools. One, Science Leadership Academy is now at district headquarters at 440 North Broad. They had been at a synagogue across the street. They're now, everyone's going to be together in the new year at 440. And Benjamin Franklin is in a rented space that used to be a former charter school. So, you know, there are a lot of cases where the district has had to take on extra expense because they have to put these students in a safe place.
Yeah. So even as they're struggling with the funding for fixing the problem, now there's the whole issue of having to rent all this space.
Extra costs.
Kristen, is there talk about, because these buildings, many of them are old, you've written that they're older than 70, many of them.
Average age is older than 70.
So is there a point at which they decide that it's cheaper to just start again? Is there talk about tearing buildings down and starting again? Does the cost of repair come close to the cost of starting
again? It really varies. I mean, in the case of Pierce Elementary, which is in North Philadelphia, that school is ultimately going to be torn down and replaced. That was planned for in the district's capital budget, you know, before the asbestos became, you know, a real front burner issue. So there's questions now about whether the students at Pierce will ever return to that building. I think the construction the demolition of the old building and construction of the new is not scheduled to start, I believe, until 2021. And so there's a question of where those students are going to be in September. But in terms of, you know, tearing every school down that had asbestos and or damaged asbestos and redoing it, I mean, that's just not financially feasible. Yeah. That would be, you know, billions and billions of dollars, and no one's, you know, that funding just isn't there. Yeah.
What about the loss of instruction time? Have students lost significant time in the process of this relocating?
So again, it depends on the school. Benjamin Franklin and Science Leadership Academy both lost, you know, weeks of instruction. Science Leadership Academy was a little bit better able to cope because they are, you know, were sort of set up for a digital model. All their students have laptops, you know, they were in better position to be able to do some kind of distance learning. Benjamin Franklin is a traditional public high school. Students were not issued laptops, you know, prior to this. And so they lost significant time. And there's a question of, you know, whether they're how they make that time up, you know, whether they take some of spring break back, whether they go later in the year. I mean, certainly the district could appeal to Harrisburg to say, you know, these are special circumstances. Can we have a waiver? Mm-hmm. But, you know, certainly some time will need to be made up. Also, the students at Pierce Elementary, some of them did miss significant time as well.
You mentioned laptops and how some students are able to do sort of long distance schoolwork and others are not. And you wrote, Kristen, about the role of race and class and privilege in which schools get attention and how much. What did you learn in the process of doing that story?
So definitely this is a real hot button issue when the Pierce situation happened. And I know Mr. Little is going to speak to this later, but basically, you know, we had heard that there were some problems at Pierce, and, you know, I essentially told him that there was asbestos in his children's school. There was no letter from the district, no communication, and the district was not as quick to respond as they had been at some other schools. Now, the district said to me this was an issue of, you know, we knew about this. They knew about the asbestos that had been brought to their attention by the Philadelphia Federation of Teachers. They said we didn't have the resources to respond to it quickly because, you know, we had so much going on at Science Leadership Academy and Benjamin Franklin High School. You know, but obviously to the parents at Pierce, this was not a good enough answer. You know, they felt like they were not given the priority that other schools had been given because, you know, it's a largely minority school. It largely educates kids of color. And so, you know, they said, this is not fair. This is, you know, racism. This is classism. Yeah. And there was some, you know, joining forces. There were parents at Meredith Elementary School, which is a more affluent school in a more affluent neighborhood. And they had, you know, asbestos issues at their school. There was a teacher, a Meredith teacher, who was diagnosed with mesothelioma, the fatal cancer. And so after that teacher was diagnosed, the district sort of went into Meredith and said, okay, these are things we need to fix immediately. There were some spaces of the school that were closed off while that work was done. And some of the Meredith parents kind of joined force with the Pierce parents and said, yeah, we're lending our voice to this too. We believe this is not equitable.
Yeah. Speaking of that teacher, I did read your piece about her. Can you bring us up to speed? How is she doing? What's going on?
Sure. So the teacher is a woman named Leah DeRusso, who has mesothelioma, and she had what's known as kind of a hot chemo surgery. It's called HIPEC. Essentially, she was cut open, and then the diseased parts, you know, that surgeons could remove, they removed, and she was given essentially heated chemotherapy. It was a very intense surgery that happened last week. She was in intensive care. She just got out of intensive care, but still remains in a lot of pain and definitely has a tough fight ahead of her.
And mesothelioma is a very aggressive cancer. I mean, we see, you know, commercials about it sometimes on television, but I don't know that most people really know what that is.
Yeah, mesothelioma is a cancer that really is only the only known cause is asbestos. And, you know, usually the prognosis is pretty awful, you know, 6 months to, you know, the miracle cases last several years. But, you know, this is a fatal cancer. It's not something that's a curable cancer.
Yeah. And Ms. DeRusso, this teacher had been in this building for many years.
So she taught at Meredith and at Nebinger, both schools in South Philadelphia that had known damaged asbestos issues. And, you know, Leah sort of talked about in her classroom, which was one that we know had flaking asbestos, there was a pipe that had insulation that was asbestos insulation. And she, you know, was a terrific teacher who loved to display student work. And so she would get up on a chair and kind of string some string and hang student work. And sometimes when she would pull the string,
mm-hmm. like a clothesline,
right, kind of essentially thing. A clothesline, yeah. You know, there would be some dust on the floor that she would sweep up. And, you know, we know that if that was indeed, you know, damaged asbestos, that that was potentially very dangerous to her.
Yeah. And I remember reading, too, that sometimes she would come in and it would be on the desk or on the floor and, you sort of sweep it away and move on.
Correct. I mean, the desk had such an issue that, you know, she was issued her own broom to clean up because, you know, it was something that this is just what you deal with and you clean it up and, you know, you're not going to wait for a custodian who has the whole school to take care of. You're just going to sweep it up yourself and move on.
Yeah. So mesothelioma, obviously, an aggressive cancer, you know, a worst case scenario. What are some of the other health risks that students and staff might be facing if they're in a building where there are some of these places that are imminent hazards?
Sure. We know that a lot of children in Philadelphia, higher rates of kids have asthma, and that certainly any respiratory ailment are things that could be triggered by asthma. You know, there are other cancers that could be stirred up. It's just, you know, and a lot of it, we don't know for mesothelioma. It's not like you are exposed and then you get cancer quickly. It could be, you know, 10, 20, 40 years from now. You know, Ms. DeRusso taught in Philadelphia schools for 30 years, so.
Yeah. There is so much more that we want to cover, and we mentioned that we will be hearing momentarily from a parent whose children have been displaced from an elementary school, a parent who's been very active in engaging the school district around all of these issues. We also want to invite you to join in our conversation. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, call us at 888-474-7-9499. We'll be back with much more on the issue of asbestos in Philly schools and how the district is addressing it when Radio Times Regional Roundup comes right back. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. We have been talking about a growing environmental crisis in the Philadelphia public school system. It is asbestos, damaged asbestos specifically, and now six schools have had to close and students and staff have had to be relocated because in these buildings there was damaged asbestos that has been determined to be an imminent hazard. And so we've been talking with Kristen Graham. She is a reporter for the Philadelphia Inquirer. She has been covering this story. And in just a moment, we will hear from the parent of three children who have been displaced from their elementary school. We welcome your comments and questions as well. Email us at radiotimes@whyy.org, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, call us 888-477-9499. Speaking of phone calls, I'd like to go to the phones because we've got a teacher from McClure, which is one of the schools that was recently closed. Rachel is standing by to talk to us. Rachel, welcome to Radio Times.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for calling.
So my concern is for the rest of the children and staff in the city of Philadelphia, because it took our staff 4 months to get anyone to come out and take a walkthrough. Once we had the district walkthrough, There were no imminent hazards found until 2 weeks later after more continued pushing by our staff. So my concern is for the rest of the staff of the School District of Philadelphia so that they're aware that it will take a lot of advocacy from them to make sure that their schools and their children and their families are safe.
Well, Rachel, thank you for calling in and something that you've seen firsthand, Kristen.
Definitely. And I think, you know, the peer situation certainly speaks to that, that in some cases, you know, hazards are flagged and checked out quickly. And in other cases, folks have reported that, you know, they've had to wait a long time. And as the McClure teachers have said, advocate, you know, repeatedly.
Yeah, it's squeaking wheel. And we are waiting to hear from the Philadelphia School District as well to weigh in on this issue. So once we get that statement, we will let you know about that. But in the meantime, we have been promising that we would be talking with a parent from T.M. Pierce Elementary School who has three children who have been displaced by this asbestos issue. So Antoine Little is standing by to talk with us. Antoine, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you. Good morning. Thanks for having me. Good morning, Ms. Graham.
Hey, Mr. Little.
So you two obviously know each other, and that was actually, Antoine, my first question for you. You found out about this through Kristen Graham.
Yes. Ms. Graham had reached out to me to ask for a comment in reference to the asbestos in the lead that was found in the school, and I was floored because we knew nothing about it. I had no notice from school, no notice from the district, nothing to that effect. And I was just, I sat there on the phone for a few seconds with my mouth open because I didn't know what to say.
Mm. So having received that news, what did you do next?
I was immediately angered and I called my wife and I told my wife what was going on. And, you know, being a part of this an education activist for like the last 8 or 9 years, I immediately, you know, reached out to some of my resources and said, hey, listen, I want to have a protest rally outside of the school on Monday morning. We need to bring the parents on board about what's going on, and they need to be a part of this process so that we can begin to, you know, get some answers from the district.
So, Antoine, it sounds like you're no stranger to shaking things up when it's when it's called for.
No, not at all. Not at all.
And had you not done that, I mean, you've sort of engaged parents now and kind of gotten the ball rolling here. But had you not done that, what do you think might have happened?
Honestly, I think that the district would have kind of swept this under the rug, had no noise been made, and it would have been business as usual. And to speak to Rachel's comments a few minutes ago, where she said, you know, she talked about, you know, the staff was making noise and they had concerns and they kind of fell on deaf ears. You know, that was definitely the situation at Pierce. Some of the staff had told me that, hey, we've been talking about this issue for a while and no one would listen to us. And I mean, I really believe that once the parents begin to make noise, that's when the district, you know, takes this issue and matter serious. But the parents, no matter what school you're in, the parents are the ones who's going to have to step up and begin to say, hey, this issue is serious. This issue is cause for concern, and we need it addressed. I mean, I know the teachers union have been making noise about it as well, but it, like you said, the squeaky wheel always gets the attention. So you have to make the noise in order to get their attention.
So obviously your children are being relocated. The district is responding. How have you found the response to be since you began to advocate for the issue to be addressed?
So I think that once we began to make noise, the district began to, focus more attention on T.M. Pierce by relocating them to the 3300, because originally they were talking about bringing in porta potties because the issue was found in the basement and in the school gymnasium, but it was in a common area. So they were talking about shutting the basement down, putting porta potties, some fancy porta potties, excuse me, in the schoolyard, and the students would be allowed to be taken outside to go to the bathroom. And we as the parents, when we began to have these meetings, we said, oh, no, that's not acceptable. Our children are not going outside to no bathrooms. You guys have to find something else. And then they took us to AP Hill and they took us to Pratt Arnold. And what's funny about that is had the issue about Pierce not been raised, then the issue at Pratt would have never been found. And so they took us to those schools. They were unacceptable. So then the district found this location, a former college and as well a charter school. And they put our children over there. They bus them every day. But to kind of back up a little bit, you know, some of the people that we were communicating with that were that were actually helping us get this process started, Dr. Bird, he's since resigned. And I forget her other name. I forget the other young lady's name off the top of my head right now. But she has been moved to another position. And these were people that we had direct contact with, and we were supposed to have been meeting on the regular to actually begin talks about the next move. And then after the next move, the demolition and the rebuild of the new campus for TM Pierce.
So it's frustrating because the people who were your regular contacts now are not there.
Exactly.
So that creates some complications. And Antoine, in the school district's defense, you know, it's a fact that there's just nowhere near enough money to address the magnitude of this problem. And so you've got schools all over the place that have all of these environmental issues. What do you say to, you know, to their response that, look, you know, of course we're concerned about safety. We've got limited resources and we're doing the best we can with the resources that we have.
I mean, and I clearly understand that, you know, it's a financial situation, and that's why we need our elected officials to step up to the plate to begin to advocate for money for our schools here in Philadelphia. Like just last week, State Representative Elizabeth Feeler, she called a rally and protest at the state capitol last week asking for, you know, the House in Harrisburg to come up with some funding so that we can get this emergency fix for our schools. So I think, again, it's going to take the voters and the parents to actually go and lobby with these elected officials who control the dollars, who controls where the funding goes. And we have to go to these people and tell them this is a dire emergency here in Philadelphia, and we need funding so that our schools can be adequate enough, not just for our students, but for our staff, because our staff is in the building alongside our children for 8, 9 hours, 10 hours a day, and they're all affected, and we need the funding to come in.
And to that point, Kristen, I was reading about how Senator Hughes, I believe it was, sent an open letter to the governor lobbying for more of this funding.
Absolutely. And Senator Hughes has been, you know, tightly aligned with Governor Wolf. He was, you know, kind of an important surrogate for him during his initial run for governor, and has been close with him since. And so, you know, that's not nothing that he sent an open letter to the governor. But at the same time, you know, it's not just the governor, but we're looking at, you know, the legislature, which, as we've said, is not warm at all to Philadelphia.
Yeah. Antoine, tell us a little bit about your children. You've got three of them who are affected by this. How old are they, and what does this relocation mean for you and your family?
So our children are 8, 9, and 11. The adjustment hasn't been too bad because, I mean, they have to get up maybe a little bit earlier because they have to be at the school at a certain time to get the bus that's going to transport them to, you know, back and forth to school. My wife has went out there a couple mornings to just see how everything was going. A few days I was able to get off of work. I was out there to see how the process goes. It's a little hectic because it's still early in terms of the children and the staff getting adjusted to this. But overall, I think it's a good process. I think that, you know, it could possibly use some tweaking. But overall, the staff at TM Pierce have been exceptional in terms of making do with the space that they've been given because, of course, this is not their home school. So they have, you know, they have made adjustments to do as much as they can possible to make the children as comfortable as possible so that they don't miss too much more of the education time. And, you know, my children missed about, I want to say roughly maybe about a month from school.
Wow.
Because my wife and I made the conscious decision to keep our children home because we were not aware of everything. We asked for certain findings in terms of air quality tests, and we asked for certain results from tests that were, you know, conducted by the district. And to be honest, we still have yet to been given that information. So we don't know. We didn't know anything. So we just made the conscious decision to take our children out. But to TM Peer's credit, again, to the staff, they worked with us in terms of creating homework packets and creating packets that the children can do during the daytime, and giving us work that they can do on the computer so that they can keep up as much as possible, even though that doesn't constitute, you know, it's not equivalent to classroom time, but it still kind of kept them up to speed.
Yeah. Well, Antoine, before we let you go and get back to your day, what do you want the superintendent and the school district to know and to do going forward?
I mean, I know we just need them to take all of our children and every staff member that works for the district. We need them to take this serious, but we also need our district along with the parents to lobby our elected officials to end the 10-year tax abatement, not just adjust it, to get funding in from Harrisburg so that our schools can continue to run, but run in a safe and effective manner. Like, we just need all of our leaders to step up and do what is needed to be done so that our children can succeed. And no one's economic background should constitute what kind of education that you receive or what kind of building that you go to. Yeah. That's all. I need everyone to understand that.
Well, Antoine Little, thank you so much for taking time to talk with us. We know that it's a busy week this week for everybody, and we so appreciate your time. And all the best to you and your family going forward.
Thank you, and thank you for having me, and happy holidays to you and your listeners, as you as well, Ms. Graham.
Thanks, Mr. Little. Take care.
Bye-bye.
So we also have, I want to go back to the phones, Kristen, before we wrap up our conversation, but Rhonda has been standing by patiently waiting to join in on the conversation. Welcome, Rhonda, to Radio Times.
Hi, thank you. Good to be on.
Well, thanks for calling in. What's your comment or question?
My comment is that I used to be a student 48 years ago at TM Peers, and I have to say there was problems back then. And it just shocks me that this problem is still arriving today. We're still dealing with the same thing. Not only with the, you know, summertime, there's no air conditioning in the schools, and, you know, I'm 48 years old and it's still like this, but the asbestos and the lead. And we were looking for our people that's in charge of the school district to do something about it. Well, sorry to break the news to everybody, but it's always been there ever since I was a kid in school. And when we wake up and stop depending on these people supposed to be doing good for us and making sure our children is getting educated, we've been blindsided and the jig is up. We need to get all those elected officials out. The old school program is not working for us, and we need to, as parents, fight for our kids and realize we're being lied to. We're going to continue to be lied to. It's going to get swept under the rug, and nothing's going to be done about it. And our children and teachers and staff members are going to continue to be poisoned and lied to. And this is what I have. I have no hope now. It's like this is the last straw, and it's like it's degrading, and it's just a problem, and it's sad that even to this day we're still going through dealing with lead and asbestos in our schools. So it's almost as if it's meant to be. That's what they want.
Well, Rhonda,
thank
you. We appreciate your call and the points that you have made, and I think the good news is that now that there has been publicity, thanks to people like Kristen and some parents like Antoine who have been really advocating that some things are starting to move forward. I think also, Kristen, that Rhonda brings up a really important point, which is that it's not just asbestos. Lead paint is an issue in the Philadelphia schools as well, and a very serious one that is affecting the health of students.
Absolutely. Excuse me. And my colleagues, Wendy Ruderman, Barbara Laker, and Dylan Purcell, you know, were Pulitzer finalists for a series called Toxic City, Six Schools, which talked about, you know, asbestos problems and lead problems and other environmental issues in Philadelphia schools. And so it's not as if, you know, this is a revelation that asbestos is there. You know, it has been well documented. You know, it just kind of took a groundswell, you know, the Leah DeRusso being diagnosed with mesothelioma, you know, Benjamin Franklin and science leadership Leadership Academy, you know, having the asbestos for people to take notice.
Yeah, sometimes that's what it takes. And that Toxic City series is available if you go online. The Inquirer did an incredible job of documenting these environmental issues that the school district, staff, students, teachers, parents are all fighting and up against right now. Kristen Graham from the Philadelphia Inquirer, thank you so much for taking time to share your insights and help us understand this asbestos issue so much better.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We also want to thank our producers, John Ahrens, Kelsey Hansen, Debbie Builder. They are all Radio Times producers, and our engineer is Diana Martinez. And I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Mary Cummings Jordan. You have been listening to the Radio Times Regional Roundup on WHYY.